Let's open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 2, verse 31, and resume our story of how Daniel, one of the junior advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar, becomes the head advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the year is 603 BC. Daniel has finished recently his 3 years of intensive training in order to enter into the service of Nebuchadnezzar. He is probably still in his teens, although I suppose if he was taken from Judea when he was in his later teens, he might be in his very early 20s now. King Nebuchadnezzar has only been on the throne for part of 3 years. It's his second official year by Babylonian records. And he is in his upper 30s. Maybe by now he's turned 40. So we're talking about Daniel being half the age, plus a little bit more of a gap than that, of the king to whom he's speaking. And you remember that the king had this dream that really bothered him. Apparently he had it multiple times. He demanded that his advisors, the senior ones, tell him first the dream and then the interpretation, which of course they couldn't do, and they tried to explain to him, nobody's ever asked that of us before. Only a god could provide that inside information of a dream. And so Nebuchadnezzar had demanded that the whole advisory council, from top to bottom, be executed. But Daniel asked for time and was given it, and now he is in the presence of the king explaining first the dream and then what it means. So let's read it again. Daniel chapter 2, verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and exceeding brightness, and so it's very shiny, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. So it's huge. It's monstrous. The head of this image was of fine gold. Its chest and two arms, I put the number in there, but remember, there's always two arms. Its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs, so its midsection, its abs, its belly, and the thighs down at the top of the two legs, they're made of bronze. Its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, all together were broken in pieces, became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. And no doubt Nebuchadnezzar went, exactly. That's exactly what it was. Now tell me what it means. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, and we as Christians are used to using that title for Jesus, but it was a Babylonian title for particularly the Babylonian emperor, the king over all the kings of the kingdoms around him. So you, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you ruler over them all, you are the head of gold. So a little reminder at the beginning of the explanation. Daniel says, you are king. You are the emperor of the growing Roman Empire, or the growing Babylonian Empire, because God, the real God, the creator God, he gave you the job. And so you, in this dream, are the head of gold. Now, it's Nebuchadnezzar personally, but not exclusively. It's his Babylonian dynasty. They are the first on this image. And this is important because this image prophetically foreshadows the history all the way up to the time of Jesus Christ's second coming. But a lot of it will come to pass by the time of the New Testament story of Jesus. And so we'll talk about that as we decode this with Daniel. So another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you. As we go down the statue, the metals are less valuable, but harder. And that's exactly what we'll see with the kingdoms that the Jewish people, because that's where the connection is, that the Jewish people are put under in the history that is yet future at the time that Daniel's giving all this information. So the next kingdom, the silver kingdom, which would be the shoulders and the two arms, that's going to be the Medes and the Persians. The Medes will be the first part of that dual kingdom, but the Persians will be the major players as it progresses. And then yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And when we say over all the earth, it's the known world of the Jewish Middle East. And so the third kingdom here, the bronze kingdom, will be the Macedonian Greeks that will come spreading to the east out of Greece, out of Macedon, under Alexander the Great. And they will bring with them bronze weaponry, which is very interesting. Verse 40, and there shall be a fourth kingdom in this series, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. So the iron kingdom is the Roman Empire, which will come up and eventually push eastward. And it will take out the remnants of the Greek or Macedonian kingdom. It will also deal with what is remaining of the Medo-Persian and Babylonian cultures. It will oversweep much of their territory. And interestingly enough, what do the Romans use? They use iron and even a little bit of steel. Verse 41 is important to us Christians. As you see the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. Now, we're getting into speculative stuff here, but I think it's reasonable speculation. These toes, these 2 feet with 10 toes, is showing what eventually happens to the Roman Empire. Because the Roman Empire, over time, after the close of the Gospel period, first it divides into 2 parts, that would be the 2 legs, and then it then breaks up into many, many, many different kingdoms, which are fighting with one another and vying with one another over history, even into the era that we're living in right now, particularly in the Western Roman Empire remnant, where all the European democracies are competing with one another. But there's always been this underlying desire among many people to bring the empire back together again, bring these kingdoms back together into a powerful unit. And the European Economic Union, and then eventually what became the EU, the European Union, is the most recent example of that. Now, there's been other examples. The Third Reich of Hitler tried to do that. And also the Holy Roman Empire under Charlemagne tried to do all that. But eventually, in the time period that's represented in the book of Revelation, the final 3.5-year period before Jesus Christ comes back, there will be a singular kingdom that has 10 specific kings involved or leaders involved, and then an 11th that becomes kind of the dictator over them. And so those last 10 toes in this vision represents the final beast leader's kingdom. And I'm very, very confident that that is the proper way of looking at this passage. So we know that it is in its latter stages, not very strong, still got divisions that want to break it apart. Verse 42, as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so that kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And as you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. And we know that that happened a lot in Europe, and it still happens to this day. But they will not hold together just as iron does not mix with clay, because there's all these underlying competitions going on. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut out from the mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. So Jesus' millennial kingdom, the kickoff to eternity under his reign, that's what will bring down the beast leader's kingdom. Will bring down the 10 leaders and then the dictator, beast leader that goes along with that. That's all in the book of Revelation, and we get a little bit more of it later in the book of Daniel as well. So here is the first introduction of that concept, that Jesus, upon his return as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he will be the rock of God that will establish the eternal kingdom. Now, there are some people in their interpretation of this that they want the kingdom of Jesus to start with his first coming. And in many regards, it does, for he is every Christian's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But his kingdom is not yet on this earth. That will not happen until his second coming and the new heaven and new earth come into existence. And so that's why I believe this prophecy goes from the time of Nebuchadnezzar all the way beyond us to the time of the millennial kingdom. Let's finish up this verse 45. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. So that's how he finishes his presentation. The real God, the only God, has decided that you should receive the first information about how things are going to play out over time. Because you're the first kingdom, and then there'll be three others after you, and then some version of that last kingdom, we're talking about the Roman Empire, is going to be knocked out by the coming of the Messiah, the coming of the rock of God that is cut out without human hands. Verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel. So he is very impressed by what just happened that nobody else was able to do. He told him exactly what the dream was, and it's a very specific dream. It would be hard to just guess any of these things. So he tells him the specifics of the dream and then tells him that the dream stretches out over time. So Nebuchadnezzar honors Daniel by kneeling in front of him and thanking him for this information. And by doing this, he's actually honoring the God of Daniel. And he commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. Now, Daniel would have been uncomfortable with the idea of him receiving such worship-like honors, and I'm sure he would have voiced that he wanted these things to be directed toward the true and living God that was working through him. Verse 47, the king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. So there it is. In the conversations between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, it is clear that it is God, he who is, that is due all these honors, because he alone has been able to provide all this information to Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. So this is where Daniel is suddenly promoted ahead of everybody else. He is pushed way into the front of many that were much senior to him in age and in time of service. So if you can imagine somebody that's either in his second half of his teens or maybe right around 20 years of age, he is suddenly the senior counselor to the king, the senior advisor to the king, and he is in charge of all of these other advisors. They have to treat him as if he were their superior, because he is, by all the standards of Babylon. And Daniel is also going to be in charge of a lot of the stuff happening in the empire. He is taking care of everything. And then he makes a special request to the king. Daniel, verse 49, made a request of the king that he would appoint Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, that's their Babylonian names. Their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. His prayer partners in this episode. So he requests that these three men be appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. So he asked that his three guys be promoted just under him. So we've got four senior advisors now that are in their later teens, maybe right around 20. Jewish guys that are advising the king and running things around the core of the empire. Now, Daniel has to travel around to do things with the king and for the king. So that is probably why he's not in the next story that comes up in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 3. But we're not quite ready for that story just yet. Instead, we're going to jump over to the historical book of 2 Kings chapter 24, where we read this. In his days, which is just a reference to Jehoiakim, the king, in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. So that goes back to the idea that in 605, Nebuchadnezzar comes through Judea and basically lays down the law that the Babylonians are now going to be in charge in Judea. And Jehoiakim, as much as he hates it, is forced to become a vassal to King Nebuchadnezzar. And so he pays the tribute money in 604, 603, 602. But after those 3 years of tribute paid, he decides to rebel, and he refuses to repay tribute in 601. Now, this is interesting because the Babylonian Chronicle tells us that Nebuchadnezzar, in that particular year, had come down through the area of Judea along the coast and had tried to invade Egypt, but he was repelled by the Egyptian forces. He could not get it done. And so it may be that Jehoiakim saw that defeat happen and decided maybe this would be a good time to quit paying tribute to Nebuchadnezzar and reach out to the Egyptians as a potential ally to get them out from underneath this boot of Babylon. But this is not what God wants done. God has been telling the Judean people and the king Jehoiakim specifically for years before Jehoiakim became king, that the Babylonians are coming, that they will be the agents of judgment from God, and that the Judeans should simply submit to what's coming and repent of their sin. So when Jehoiakim decides to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, that's the same as rebelling against he who is. So God ups the pressure on him. Verse 2 of 2 Kings 24. He who is sent against him, bands of the Chaldeans, so that would be some more of the Babylonian military units, bands of Syrians, that would be north of the Promised Land, in the area that's still called Syria to this day, which is under Babylonian control, and bands of Moabites and bands of the Ammonites. And those are people related to Israel, but living across the Jordan River Valley on the other side of the Dead Sea. And they, whenever they sense weakness amongst the kingdom of, within the kingdom of Judah, they've very often invaded and tried to take resources. So apparently they sense that Judah is weak enough to be harvested for their own purposes. So we've got all these different groups that are now coming into the Judean kingdom and taking stuff. And he, meaning God, sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of he who is, that he spoke by his servants, the prophets. So this is all in accordance with God's warnings that judgment is coming. Verse 3, surely this came upon Judah at the command of he who is to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood that he has shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and he who is would not pardon. And that goes back as a reminder that the point of no return for the kingdom of Judah happened in the bulk of King Manasseh's reign. Even though he repented later and did his best to try to turn things around in the last few years of his reign, it was his sinful choices, his sinful leadership that took Judah over the cliff. And so everything that happens from that point onward is leading to their eventual judgment. Now let's go back to the prophetic book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 35. And we don't know exactly when this prophecy comes into the story, but I've placed it here because it, I think it fits with the ongoing warnings of Jeremiah to the kingdom, that they are screwed up, that they are out of step with God, and they should have known better. So chapter 35, verse 1. The word of he who is that came to Jeremiah in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. So it's right around this time period. Here's the message. Go to the house of the Rechabites and speak with them and bring them to the house of he who is into one of the chambers and then offer them wine to drink. So the Rechabites are an ethnic group, a family that is living inside of the Judean kingdom, but they are not ethnic Israelis. Their ancestors came into the country with Joshua and the Israelis of that time period because they were related to Moses. They had been in the wilderness with them. One of the brothers of Moses' wife from Midian had served as a guide during some of the wilderness wanderings, and he and a lot of his relatives and associates decided to move into the promised land with them. And so the Rechabites are one of the genetic lines that came from those groups. So Jeremiah is supposed to invite these guys who worship the true and living God, but are not ethnic Israelis, to come to the temple, to the Temple Mount, into one of the little side chambers in the court, and offer them wine to drink. Now, offering wine in the temple was not unusual. A lot of the people came to eat of the sacrificial food that had been offered, and they would drink the wine that was normal, ordinary use in that time period as part of that meal. So this is not a big, unusual thing for him to do, except for one point. Verse 3. So I took Jehazaniah, the son of Yeremiah. Notice the IA ending on their names indicates Yah, the shortened form of Yahweh. So these guys are involved in the worship of the true and living God. He is part of their worship lifestyle. And so he is now going to talk to them about doing something that is against their own personal family faith based on something an ancestor said. But we're out of time, so let's save that for the next time we get into God's Word.